Today's program is brought to you by Michter's Distillery. Visit Michter's.com to find out how their taste is everything, cost be damned attitude is creating some of the finest whiskeys available.
I'm Grace Bonney of After the Jump, and you're listening to Heritage Radio Network, broadcasting live from Bushwick, Brooklyn. If you like this program, visit heritageradionetwork.org for thousands more.
Good morning. You're listening to In the Drink on heritageradionetwork.org. I'm your host, Joe Campanelli, and today we have a very special guest, Mr. Alex Day. He's co-owner of a bunch of very fine drinking establishments around the country, most notably for me at least, Death & Co., which opened up in the East Village, 7, 8 years ago.
Yeah, coming up on 8 years.
8 years. Oh, my goodness. A place that I've been many, many, many times. Also Honeycut in L.A., Nightcap, King & Eddie Saloon, and all in L.A., and the Rose and the Pink Garter Theater in Jackson Hole, Wyoming. Also co-owner of Proprietors LLC, which Alex is just filling me in on, helps to open up a bunch of consultant bars and kind of turn over a high quality cocktail bar to anyone who would like to buy one. Is that accurate, or less?
Yeah, great marketing material. Thank you.
And Alex and I actually have known each other for quite some time. Back in senior year of college, we were both kind of trudging through. Well, I was trudging. You were flying easily, flying through senior year, the honors thesis class for European studies. And sadly, I had no idea that at the time that you had such a passion for the industry. I like to think that hopefully we would have had a cocktail together back then.
Truly.
Welcome to the show. Very exciting to have you on the show.
Thank you. Pleasure to be here.
You know, usually we start off the show with the best or most interesting wine I've had in the last week. But this week we're going to change it up in honor of Alex. We're going to have a most interesting cocktail I've had last week. And the most interesting cocktail I had in the last week was over at the Franklin Mortgage and Loan Company in Philadelphia. It's very, very cool. I was just in Philadelphia. I got back late last night for the Alex's Lemonade Stand event. And there, over at Franklin Bar, they had a cocktail called the Drop Frame, which had a great rum agricole, rum JM, Bonal, which I love to use it in drinks as often as I possibly can. A bunch of different bitters, and creme de pompomousse, which is fun to say. And the cool thing about this, and what attracted me to this cocktail, is that it was served at room temperature. And it was actually a muggy day in Philly, and I wasn't that excited of. I wanted a refreshing drink, but they talked me into it. They said they have room temperature cocktails all year round, and this is kind of a summery version of one. So that was the best drink I've had all week, and I was sharing this with Alex before the show got started, and two things came up. Number one, I had no idea that you consulted on Franklin, which is super cool. And anyone I asked about where to drink good cocktails in Philadelphia, everyone said Franklin. They said Franklin is like the place to go for people taking it really seriously, but also having some fun with it, which we definitely experience. And then number two, something that I wanted to ask you about is this idea of a room temperature drink. I know you travel around the country quite a bit more than I do and go to great cocktail bars in different cities. Is it something that you see that's coming around? Because it was pretty new to me.
Yeah, I think it's... I think it's less of a trend as though it's going to find its place on every cocktail menu in the same way that, say, you know, a daiquiri variation or an old-fashioned variation will, because that format is so solid and so tried and true and kind of sticks in people's brains so dramatically. But, you know, the idea of temperature and what happens with aroma, you know, I'm sure you talk about this a lot in wine. Those ingredients you just talked about can be so aromatic and so... so pungent in a lot of ways. And when you start playing with temperature and doing something closer to room temperature, when you're, you know, not deadening things down with really, really cold temperatures, you can do a lot. I mean, like pamplemousse, for example, grapefruit liqueur, like what happens when you brighten that up with higher temperatures is amazing. So I certainly see it as a interesting idea. I think it's as much academic as it is practical mm-hmm. in a bar setting, but when it's done well, it can be really cool. When it's done badly, just like any drink, it's awful.
Okay, so what are some of the parameters if you were going to approach, say, one of your clients maybe said, I would love, I'm so into this room temperature cocktail thing, I think it's the next big thing, and you were to say, all right, these are some rules that you need to abide by that will help you successfully create delicious room temperature cocktails, and then stay away from doing these things.
I would say the most important one is ABV, alcohol content. You know, if you're doing a room temperature cocktail, you inevitably are playing with people's senses and their ability to drink it probably quicker than they otherwise would, because they're not, it's not, you know, a cold drink that you're kind of, slowed down by. It's quenching. Room temperature cocktail is going to approach your senses a very different way. And my first instinct would be to split it mostly with a base of fortified wine of some sort. Mm-hmm. That said, if somebody was really, really into it, I would counsel them strongly to start out slowly, to do one on their menu. And in the case of the drink that you had, I would wager to say that, you know, the Agricole and the Bonal were working in tandem as a base on that, so that you had mostly the Bonal, the Agricole bringing a lot of flavor to it. But, you know, it's dangerous territory with high proof spirits and drinking them neat. And that's essentially what you're doing in a room temperature cocktail, right? You're combining things at a neat level.
Yeah, but especially in the context of a cocktail bar where you're hoping to serve multiple cocktails to your guests.
Totally.
If you have a high proof cocktail, then that's something that they're going to drink super slowly. So that makes total sense to me.
Yeah, business sense and all that.
Business sense and all of that. And then tell me a little bit about the process of how did that work when you went down and consulted with Franklin, and was what is that like? I didn't know that there were too many people in this country who are doing that.
Okay. Yeah, it was right place and right time. You know, when we were finishing up school, and it was not easy for me. That was a gnarly seminar that we were doing. I looked around and was looking at the industry and loved what I was doing. I loved bartending and Death & Co. open at the same time, so I like dove right into it. I became a partner there about 3 years ago. But the owner of that
place... Congratulations on that.
Thank you very much. It's, you know, the bar that changed my life, so to be a partner there is unreal.
It's funny. I always assumed going in that you had some sort of ownership because you felt like it felt like that was your spot. Like you took ownership over it. Everyone knew you. So it makes total sense. And I love to hear that as well, that you worked there for 6 years. They recognize your dedication, your hard work, and you're rewarded and you guys are working on other things together. It's something that you don't see in this industry as much anymore. People staying around, there aren't like too many Derek Jeters anymore.
Right. Yeah. nice reference.
Thank you.
There's that. Yeah. You know, loyalty is a powerful thing. And I think one of the things that has made Death & Co. so special is that the people that have worked there throughout the years, and I think I'm included in that, have made the bar part of our DNA. And so, you know, a person who was working there at the time can't be spoken in a sentence without referencing that bar, which makes it so special. You go in there and you feel the people. And we've always, you know, from an employee side of things, we always felt that we were motivated to be that, to make the bar ours, to have Death & Co. not be about the owners, but about the bartenders there. And then, of course, that was rewarded for me in working there for a long time and developing my business partnership with Dave Kaplan, who is the primary owner of Death & Co., and he and I own a bunch of other stuff together. And I think that sentiment has really like set the foundation for our entire business. Like the Franklin, for example, down in Philly, you know, they called us shortly after Dave and I decided to start, you know, working with other people. I was after college working in cocktail bars that didn't make me very much money. So I started consulting on the side, just picking up, you know, doing a menu for Allen and Delancey, for example, when that existed, a couple of other things. And these people from Philly called us. They love Death & Co. They're like, we really want to do something down here. Can you help us? And we put together a team to do all the architecture, the design, setup. And then I went down there and trained the staff and kind of bounced back and forth between here and there for a long time. And I think set the foundation there for exactly that sentiment at Death & Co., where like the staff owns the place and feels like they're involved in it. And you feel that, I hope, still to this day, because the crew there is unreal. They're so talented.
Oh, we had such a great time. Sat a sat at the bar. We were going to get there like right when they opened, and like, all right, let's take a walk around the block and like give them a second as I can, you know, relate to that, that feeling of someone walking right when the door opens, and love having your first guest, but like, let's give them a few minutes. And anyway, got there. Everyone was super nice. And the cocktail was really interesting and delicious. Which is very cool. So if you had an endless budget, these kind of, I know, and you work with your own businesses and you're consulting, you guys have to work with some sort of budget. These are real businesses, but what is one piece of cocktail equipment or design that you're like, wow, if we can go, you know, balls to the wall, do whatever, like what would you do?
Oh, you are going down a rabbit hole. As you know, restaurants and bars exist on such tight margins that sometimes it's really difficult to justify some of these expensive toys that you really love. But I had the opportunity in LA to really start diving into some more advanced equipment and basically biting Dave Arnold style as a colleague in this radio station here, pretty much as much as I possibly can, and buying a Centrifuge a couple years ago, because we have an extensive tap cocktail program at Honeycutt, clarifying juice, you know, carbonating things. It was awesome. But I recently convinced my partners in LA to allow me to buy a RotoVap, which I don't know if you know much about rotary evaporators, but it's pretty fucking cool.
Please inform us. What's a rotary evaporator?
Well, it's basically a still at its base. We're distilling something, but it's the entire process is captured within a vacuum chamber. So you're lowering temperature a bit, but mostly you're changing pressure. So, you know, if you boil a pot of water on top of a stove, you're at atmospheric pressure where we all exist and we kind of swim around in, you know, the environment around us. Water boils at a certain point based upon temperature and pressure. So if you change the pressure, you can boil at a lower point. What happens to aroma and flavor when you apply heat? Well, it changes. So if you're able to capture aroma and flavor of an ingredient, say something as delicate as basil leaves, into, say, something as delicious as gin, and you're able to distill that at a low proof, well, you get this incredibly beautiful aromatic flavor out of it that is so almost romantic, how like special it is using this laboratory tool. I'm really excited about that, though, to officially say that I don't actually distill anything with alcohol because that's illegal.
So, yes, of course.
No, ever.
If in a hypothetical, if you were to make a basil gin, like what application would you use that?
It would come out the other end pretty high proof. I'd probably, you know, add some water content just like any distillate to it, and maybe use that as a modifier, maybe use it base, maybe use it aromatic on top of a cocktail. I just got the thing, so I'm playing around with it. The grossest thing so far is toasted coconut cognac, which tastes like sunscreen.
It sounded delicious at the beginning. I can see why you might go down that.
Oh, I tried to justify everyone in the office saying, oh, this is so cool. And my colleague out in LA, Devin Tarby, who has a much better palate than I do, was like, no, this is sunscreen. It's gross.
Yeah, sometimes you have those specific, sunscreen's just gross. You don't want to eat sunscreen.
It's too attached to memory.
And about the immersion circulator, you're really getting into that as well, huh?
Yeah.
And is that specifically for tap programs, or does it have other applications?
I use a circulator for almost all of our syrups. So controlling heat, especially with like fruit syrups, something like raspberry as an example, very low temperature, around 135 degrees Fahrenheit, extracting into a sugar solution, you know, sugar. You can get like beautiful color and great flavor and not that cooked fruit roll-up thing that you would often get. But also, more interestingly, is with infusions. Alcohol starts boiling off at 174 degrees Fahrenheit at sea level. So when you apply heat to any booze in order to extract flavor, stuff starts changing. It becomes, you know, less of the original alcohol. So trapping your liquid into some sort of container, putting ingredient in there and cooking it at a lower temperature below the point at which it's going to boil off has really kind of changed how we've approached infusions and, you know, syrups for that matter.
Are they more shelf stable as well? I feel like they would be.
I mean, you're still into, generally speaking, a high proof spirit. So stability is pretty good. And then if you want to get real geeky, you can run it, you know, afterwards through a centrifuge to get out any particles of anything, which why not if you have it?
Do you have to wear a lab coat when you're doing
it? I don't think so, but I think glasses are required.
Yeah. Oh, my goodness.
Mm-hmm. Even if they're non-prescription.
How did you... So Were you always so interested in the also not only I know you're very interested in the service and history of cocktails, and I don't want to talk with you about that, but some of these more technical questions, which clearly you know what you're talking about. Have you learned most of this on the job? Is there outside reading? Is it talking with people like Dave Arnold? How do you stay up to date with what's going on with this stuff?
I think the way in which it clicked for me is I've always been technically minded, I suppose. Like, the Legos of life is always really fascinating to me, like how things are put together. I did horribly in science as a kid and in college for that matter. Not particularly engaged in it, though love the idea of it. So it's not as though like I have any background in any of it, but I think these tools and these techniques have entered our work as a response to problems that we've had. Mm-hmm. For example, Honeycutt in LA, which is an incredibly high volume bar, we'll see 500 people come through in a given night. It has two different bars. It's very complicated. So we looked at that problem. We're like, how can we get drinks that are great and up to our standards out to people faster? And so we started researching cocktails on draft. And, you know, from my perspective, why do something that I could do single serving? Like, why make a Negroni and then just put it in a keg and give it to somebody? Like, a Negroni is delicious, but it's also really easy to make. Like, that doesn't really take that much time. So how can we put something in a keg that is qualitatively different than what I could do single serving and therefore is special and a reason to come? And so I started going down the rabbit hole of like, what is everyone doing to make these things special? And got into clarification. And then, of course, like, how do you have so much more opportunity with your single ingredients to make them special? And so using circulators to extract flavor in different ways was really just a reaction to how can we make the best possible drink? And less the, oh, I want this new toy, though that sometimes interacts with it.
I mean, it makes so much sense for a high volume place where you're trying to have top quality cocktails as well. There's so much stuff that really does batch out well. I mean, I did for our event last night, I think we made like 600, 700 cocktails. There's no way I'm making each one of those one at a time. Have to batch it. You know, you have to make big batches. And there's a lot of stuff that really works well. But I guess the one thing that you generally can't put in there is citrus, right? So will you kind of add citrus? You have most of your batches, you just pour over ice or do a quick stir and then...
Yeah, anything like of the sour family style. So think your Tom Collins or your daiquiri, anything involving citrus traditionally and that like refreshing quality. We'll do two things. One, we'll either clarify the juice. So we'll run lime juice or lemon juice through a centrifuge and get out all the particles, because once you put that in keg and try to carbonate it, the CO2 doesn't dissolve very well into a mixture that has any particles floating in it, right? So we'll do that if we're getting really fancy. Or another solution, we'll make a syrup and add a good amount of, say, citric acid to it, say pineapple. Cook some pineapple with gum arabic, a little bit of sugar, and then a good amount of citric acid. And so that creates the sour balance, and it becomes more about that, the expression of that beautiful pineapple, than it does about pineapple and, say, lemon juice in there. So then you suddenly have something you could never make single serving. You have something that only works in the batch because it's all kind of working together.
That's the next level stuff. That's really
cool.
Special.
I'm really excited about it because it's a whole different approach. It's not the single serving cocktail, nor is it punch. It's like a whole different thing altogether. And then when you start tweaking on a large batch scale the formula, you start seeing that things are not there. You know, 2 ounces of booze, 3/4 ounce of lime juice, 3/4 ounce simple syrup, you suddenly can play with things in really nuanced, specific ways.
Yeah, and it's strange how you can have a recipe that works in a single serving, but if you multiply that by 10 or 100, it no longer works.
Yeah.
You really need to make adjustments at the larger end as well.
Oh, God, yeah, especially bitters. Mm-hmm. Oh, man. Any batch amount that has bitters in it, like cut it in half immediately and then taste the large batch, start adding a little bit more. It's all messing around together. And then how long it sits together. Yeah, there's a whole science. Don Lee, you should chat with him if you don't know Don. He will talk your ear off about batching, because that dude, I mean, if Tales of the Cocktail every year, he assembles thousands and thousands and thousands of cocktails.
All right. Well, we got to get Don Lee on the show. I've been talking with Joy Morales, our producer over here, and he's a bartender at Lartuzzi as well. And we've been talking about getting Don on the show. Anyway, we're going to take a quick break. We'll be back with more of Alex Day on In the Drink. Thanks a lot.
Hi, I'm Emily Peterson, host of Sharp and Hot. This summer, Heritage Radio Network is turning 5. Since our launch in 2009, we've continued to bring you food and culture content like nobody else. And we need your help. Heritage Radio Network is a passionate, grassroots, action-oriented, nonprofit organization. That means we depend on the support from listeners like you to keep us alive. If you love what you hear on Heritage Radio Network, visit our website and become a member today. Thanks for listening, and thanks for your support.
Michter's Whiskey is a proud sponsor of HeritageRadioNetwork.org. If you drink the whiskey that warmed General Washington's troops at Valley Forge, does that make you a patriot? Not necessarily, but it indicates you appreciate that Michter's sets the standard for highest quality, limited production whiskeys. America's first whiskey distilling company, Michter's rich history dates back to 1753, when a farmer in Schaeferstown, Pennsylvania, distilled his first batch of whiskey from hardy rye. At one point, a master distiller left his family's well-known distillery to join Michter's so he could be at a smaller, less cost-conscious company where he could make the finest whiskey, cost be damned. Ask your bartender or retailer for Michter's whiskey today. Chatham Imports is the national sales agent for Michter's Distillery. For more information, please visit www.michters.com. That's www.michters.com.
This is Brooks Headley, the pastry chef at Del Posto in Manhattan, and you are listening to Heritage Radio Network.
We're back on In the Drink, here with Alex Day. Alex, we started the last segment with my favorite cocktail that I had last week. What have you had any really special, really interesting cocktails, not at one of your many awesome places recently?
Oh, shit. I don't think I'm let out very often. last time I went to a place that... I went to Pouring Ribbons last night, my one time out this trip, because I've just been working, and went and visited my friend Joaquin Simo, who's, you know, we worked together at Death & Co. for a long time, and went there. I haven't been in a while, and I'm a big nerd, sci-fi nerd, and there was a drink called the Speaker for the Dead, which is a Ender's Game reference for all the geeks out there. It was delicious. It was Amaro Habano, which is like a awesome cinnamon balm of a thing, a little bit of lemon juice, for the life of me, I can't remember the base spirit, but it was stirred together with like a teaspoon of lemon juice and mint stirred into the cocktail. So you had this like, and they strained it out just like an old fashioned style drink. And it had this beautiful, like kind of herbal kick to it, but still a big glass of booze.
Ooh, that sounds nice. Awesome.
Yeah. Highly recommended.
I love Pouring Ribbons. I also just love their chartreuse program. It's just, gets me so excited.
Of course it gets you excited. There's not a psalm I know who isn't totally excited about that.
I was totally enamored by it. And yeah, just for you guys, and if you haven't been, they have you can order any of green or yellow and then older chartreuses, and they will also pour you the fresher one side by side, and it's
mind-blowing. It really is. I mean, I feel like everyone in this industry who works in beverage at all goes down some sort of chartreuse I don't know, bad kick. It's like a heroin habit. Like, they're just like, oh, I have to have chartreuse all the time. And, you know, it's not exactly the cheapest ingredient in the world.
Good stuff's expensive.
It's so expensive. And then tasting vintage stuff that has changed over the years, so cool. Have you visited over there, the monks, gone to the distillery? I had the opportunity once a couple of years ago and had a picnic with the two monks that make it was like Sound of Music shit. It was amazing. But got to taste some stuff that they don't really release outside of Europe. And like, they have a sommelier edition, which is a blend of yellow and green, but in certain proportions. And then all this, what was purported to be the way it was made back in, I think, 1605. It's really cool stuff.
That's really cool. I pictured this very, and I'm sure it is still a very secluded monastic life, but where they're just making two products and that's all they do every day. But at least it sounds like they're experimenting with a couple of other things.
Yeah, totally. I mean, so much of it's rooted in history. And, you know, the monastic life is up in the hills in this beautiful monastery surrounded by hills. And it's absolutely gorgeous. But most of the product is actually made down in Grenoble, sort of like a 30-minute drive down the hill. But yeah, they make a couple of things. They age it a little bit more. They kind of don't mess around with it. But they also make some really cool liqueurs and aperitif, something very similar to Sue's that they is just jaw-droppingly beautiful.
Did you explain what your place is like, or your places? You're like, you know, in the East Village in LA, like people like where an extremely different lifestyle are really freaking out over your stuff.
Yeah, I don't The translation didn't really work so well.
Yeah.
My French from the European Studies program, not so good.
All right. So you do a bunch of traveling. What are some of the other places, other than obviously we know about New York, San Francisco, L.A., Chicago? Like, where are some other places where you see some really great cocktails?
I think it was most inspired recently by we helped open a bar in Moscow last year, about a year and a half ago. And about this time a year, 2 years ago, I went to visit Moscow to kind of explore the opportunity and check it out. I was always fascinated by Russia in general. I was like, okay, I'll take a trip there. That sounds great. Not really expecting cocktail culture to be super advanced over there, but it was very much so. And some people who've done a lot of work in London brought over a particular aesthetic and style. And it was at that point within the cocktail culture there that sort of hub of a thought, like, you know, here 10 years ago, not 10 years ago, 8 years ago, the Milk and Honey family was very much like a thing, you know. Mm-hmm. You like go to those bars, you understand it. You go to the Pegu style bars and you understand that it's like a crew of people. Moscow a couple years ago, there was starting to be some people doing different things. And one place that really inspired me is called China, which for the life of me, I can't remember what part of town it is. It's in central Moscow near a train station, but you like go down this back alleyway and you go into this weird, sketchy building. And it's like you go down these set of stairs into a basement, and it's this perfect little special bar that's like twice as big as the room we're in right now. And one guy working behind it, and it's just so special. Like the individuality, the personality, everything that he is interested in is coming right at you. In vibes of hospitality, and just the drinks were stellar. It was Dave and I, my business partner, were there, and we're at this point in our careers where we have a number of businesses, and we're like, I don't know if we can ever do a bar like this again. Like, this is everything we want in a bar, mm-hmm. but it takes that time, that 12 hours every single day with complete and utter dedication and not being distracted by anything. That was super cool.
Wow. I was not expecting Moscow to be. Like, I thought you were going to say something completely different, like, oh, this place, New Orleans or Birmingham, which keeps coming up on the show. Everyone loves Birmingham. Moscow, that completely blows my mind, that kind of sort of dedication, huh?
Yeah, it blew my mind, too. It was such an enlightening trip, and working over there was some of the sweetest people I've ever met in my life.
Oh, that's awesome.
Yeah.
I bet you that Putin hates craft cocktails.
I bet he does.
He hates good cocktails.
I bet he... the lack of being hit. I bet he doesn't like having fun at all.
I will agree with that. I did a little research. I found some of your other kind of favorite ingredients. Apple brandy.
Oh, so much. Actually, I think I have apple brandy in my bag.
You just carry apple brandy around with you?
I was
just carrying it
around. I don't know where it is. Let's find it. I'll find it eventually. I think I have some Clear Creek apple brandy here. Sorry, go on. I'll find it.
Well, I was going to ask, other than, you know, we use the Laird's Bonded. I think mm-hmm. it's pretty solid.
Yes.
This guy just carries apple brandy with him.
I really like apple brandy.
Yeah. All right. Well, I guess we did some good research then. Do you like Clear Creek? Are there some other really delicious apple brandies that you enjoy?
It's not too early to drink, right?
No, I don't know.
There you go.
We're just going to swig it out of the bottle.
Yeah, that's the Clear Creek Poem. Of 8 year, I believe. I am generally obsessed with apple brandy.
Delicious.
Brandy in general, but apples I think are particularly cool because, thank you. The idea of terroir and how that can manifest itself in spirits I think is really dramatic in apple brandy. From the stuff that's made in Normandy in the north of France to what's made in, used to be made in New Jersey by the Laird's family. What is made in Oregon, made throughout California. There's just so many, upstate New York for that matter. There's so many amazing expressions of what apple can do as a distillate, from like really gritty, fiery American whiskey style things like Applejack to beautiful, elegant spirits. And then, you know, people in Oregon kind of playing around with where the middle ground is with that.
I was going to say that's somewhere between your Normandy, like very nice Camus or Calvados and that kind of, more fiery, rustic. That's delicious.
Mm-hmm. That's delicious. Made by really nice people in Oregon, which is where I'm from. So I got to, hold the Oregon flag high.
Dude, that's great. That's great. And the Clear Creek Distiller, if I'm correct, we just recently visited Green Hook Distillery over in Greenpoint. Mm-hmm. I think The Green Hook Distiller worked at Clear Creek for like years and years and years and years.
Yeah.
Which you probably knew that.
Yeah, it's a we've met a couple of times. The distiller, they actually just sold the distillery in Oregon to this company called Hood River Distilleries, which growing up in Oregon in the woods, like we drank their vodka, HRD vodka, in a, you know, a plastic jug. Real classy kids in Central Oregon. But this company just bought them, but I have reassurances by everyone at Clear Creek that the product's not going to change. Last time I was there, they were pulling off pears from the side of Mount Hood and letting them ripen in the distillery. So I was there as these pears were ripening, and they were distilling the eau de vie right next to them, which if you've had their pear eau de vie, it's like, it's my favorite spirit to start spirits training with because it's such a clear expression. This comes from a thing, a pear. Here's how it can be distilled. Let's talk about everything in between there. And it's just, they just make magical stuff.
Wow. Wow. They make some really good grappas.
Yeah.
Quote unquote grappas. But yeah, some grappas. You know, that, obviously, that's with the Italian restaurants, that's what interests me so much.
Yeah.
But they're actually delicious than the majority of it. More delicious than the majority of Italian grappas.
I'm glad you said it.
Yeah.
It's such a hard category. And they have a good story to it. Like, all their grappas from Clear Creek are essentially a way of maintaining the tradition of grappa, right, where you use what's left over for a purpose and don't let it go to waste. And, you know, the distiller there sources from his favorite wineries around Oregon and Washington. Like, somebody's making Pinot Grigio and Pinot Noir, of course, you know, it's not too far from the Willamette Valley. Well, I'm going to use that for my friend's winery and make a grappa out of it. And then they have all these varietals, which I don't know how many we get out here in New York, but I'm sure you've tried the full line. There's so many that they make, like almost more than anything else that they actually sell, I think, just because they think it's interesting.
Yeah, and in the terms of someone who has a like a geeky interest in this sort of thing, it's really interesting to try those single grape variety grappas.
Yeah,
they're absolutely fascinating. So I think next wave of some cocktail stuff that we were talking about, a lot of using more technology. You know, we've caught up to everything we learned before Prohibition, and now we're pushing past it. But something that I think that you guys have always nailed at Death & Co. that I'm hoping more and more places will do well at is the hospitality side of great cocktail bar. I think that you guys always been a welcoming place, a warm place. It's the name seems like a little standoffish, Death & Company. But everyone who's worked there really is kind of, I feel like, nailed hospitality. You just have such a great group of people working there. How do you nail hospitality over a bar?
Well, 5 years ago, let's call it 5 years ago just for convenience sake, I feel like within the cocktail community, there was so much talk about, hey, remember that. Yeah, get into that. There was so much talk about, hey, let's not forget that there's customers and that we're in the business of hospitality. And now, because that's been repeated ad nauseum since, it's almost like a boring statement. Like, yeah, duh, of course, we're in the business of serving people. But I feel that the sentiment still has to be repeated over and over again, especially with new people that are getting excited about this stuff. Like, you start learning about classic cocktails and all these little things that you can put together into this magical end result, which is a cocktail that miraculously comes out the other end, and you get really stoked about it. Start learning about chartreuse, and you get really excited about it. And all you want to do is tell your guests about the 134 different herbs and botanicals that go into it, even if they don't really give a shit, you know? So it's kind of like a fine line to walk in your enthusiasm and serving guests. And I think what is the most important thing to convey when we're bringing on new people is that while we fetishize and love the cocktail and putting out an amazing product that's creative as much as possible and executed meticulously, that at the end of the day, serving our guests and what their needs are is the most important thing. And I think that opportunity exists in the bar in the greatest potential than anywhere else in the restaurant. And what I mean by that is, because the informality of a bar relationship, even if you're sitting at La Bernardin, like, the relationship you have with the bartender is so much less formal than if you're sitting at a table. And because of that, you have an opportunity to break down barriers, and you can say, hey, let's have an interaction as humans and let me find you the thing that you want. And because we're bartenders and we have all these cool ingredients at our disposal, we can find quite literally exactly the right thing and build a relationship with a guest. And hopefully that is the genesis of that is hospitality and taking care of people.
Great. I couldn't have said it better. I couldn't agree more.
It's the apple brandy.
And I think he buttered me up with a couple shots of delicious, delicious apple brandy. I think it's a really important thing that you guys do extremely well. So kudos on that.
Thank you. It's very important to us.
And you know, I kind of think of Death & Company as being in the early. But the second wave of like really great cocktail bars in New York, and you might disagree with me on that. But what's really and it was one of the first to have really good food as well, which I think makes a lot of sense financially from a business standpoint. You're making people, you know, they'll stay if they're eating something, they might stay for an extra drink. And then also for the people themselves, if you've had four cocktails or three cocktails, which are so delicious, you need to have a little something in your belly. Otherwise, you're probably not going to feel great.
No, it's amazing. On the financial side of things, we had a little fire in the kitchen like a year and a half ago. These things happen. You know how it is. Yeah. Sad, blah, blah, blah. But we weren't able to serve food for a few weeks, which was a great test case for what we always assume, which was it isn't that our liquor sales or that our food sales necessarily make or break the restaurant, but what they do is increase the overall beverage sales. People stay for maybe one more drink if they have something to eat. But again, back to the second point, which is you're taking care of people and you know, looking after their hangover the next day. It's so easy in New York just to justify one or two more drinks, and suddenly it's 2 o'clock in the morning, and you've had a few, and you have to get up early because we don't have to like get into a car. We don't, you know, there's no level of that cloud hanging over our heads where that we definitely feel in Los Angeles. So having that thing to kind of soak up or at least like put a bump in the road in your evening to kind of slow things down a little bit is really, really beneficial. And I think our guests react really well to it.
I think so.
And to caring what it is too, that it's not just like, you know, a shitty pretzel on a plate. Which sounds delicious too, but
I love shitty pretzels, but if someone's spent so much time selecting these really great products and then so much care and effort setting up a beautiful bar and creating them for you, you want something a little more than a shitty pretzel on a plate.
Yeah, I would hope so.
All right, Alex, thank you so much. It's been a true pleasure to have you on the show, and I hope that we can have you back. I feel like you have so much great information. And you'll definitely be seeing me over at Death & Co. soon. Hopefully I can make it to Honeycut or Nightcap, King Eddie Saloon over in L.A. But if any of you guys go there, please go and report back. I'm sure you're going to have a really good time. All right. Alex Day, what a pleasure. Thank you so much. It's been great to have you on the show.
It was an honor. Thanks for having me.
And thanks to all of you for listening. This has been In the Drink on heritageradionetwork.org.
Thanks for listening to this program on heritageradionetwork.org. You can find all of our archived programs on our website or as podcasts in the iTunes store by searching Heritage Radio Network. You can like us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter at @heritage_radio. You can email us questions at any time at info@heritageradionetwork.org. Heritage Radio Network is a nonprofit organization. To donate and become a member, visit our website today. Thanks for listening.